Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 120, and they call it Democracy Part 3. Again, reading from Sheldon S. Wolin's book, Democracy Incorporated, Managed Democracy and the Specter of Inverted Totalitarianism, published by Princeton University Press. Wikipedia, it states Wolin made his name with the 1960 publication of Politics and Vision, Continuity and Innovation in Western Political Thought. He published a seminal article, Political Theory as a Vocation, that challenged positivist political science and enlivened the field of political theory. Wolin defended a radical account of democracy. He took it not as a form of government, but as a form of political activity which needs to be wrested away from its close association with the mega-state. During a teaching career which spanned over 40 years, Wolin mentored many graduate students who would become leading political theorists such as Cornel West, Wendy Brown, and Hannah Fennickel Pitkin. You can also find some recent interviews with Wolin by Chris Hedges. Those are videos online. This is your host, Monk. Thanks for listening. Part 3, kind of going to read my summary notes and just sort of start in on random page numbers, notes, and things that happened while reading it. Already covered the basic introduction of definition, loose definition of inverted totalitarianism, and managed democracy, hence Democracy Incorporated, another way of saying fascism under Mussolini's definition of corporate, the merging of corporate and state powers. Some of the summary notes, this is the kind of recurring themes that I noticed, politics, etc., as connected with money, economy leads to power, and the demise of that as the arise of the indigenous and the communal. That is one of the sort of, some might call it esoteric, but I think it's beyond that now. It's become more mainstream. The various prophecies of the era that we are in after the 2012, December 21st, the Mayan calendar, the tide has turned kind of thing. So I like that little rhyme. Good memory thing. If
I may say so myself, the demise and the arise. I'm sort of along the lines of it's time to choose the elite or the people. Most of the protests we see are the people protesting the elite. And much of the whole, the way that Wolin traces the aristocracy, the monarchy, the church, and all these authoritarian control systems is they regard people as if, you know, are they qualified or competent? And because that's a lot of the whatever various quote philosophers or Hobbes or whomever that even cited some of Plato as, you know, saying that the masses are, you know, they're wild, they're what's that word? Not irascible. They're sort of volatile. They're loose cannons, and they could go off. So they need to be controlled. There's basic motto there, which is, you know, contrary to the native indigenous peoples. Just started reading An Indigenous People's History of the United States by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, and interestingly, she makes note of, which is nothing new, but the consensus, a lot of the native peoples, is not just decision by majority, but consensus. And they will stay there until everybody agrees. You know, they will sit there and discuss it till everybody agrees. But then, this is interesting, I'll read from this of the book, in the rare cases in which consensus could not be reached, the segment of the community represented by dissenters might withdraw from the community and move away to found a new community. This was similar to the practice of the nearly 100 autonomous towns of northern New Mexico. So I found that quite fascinating. You know, instead of there being a problem, a war, a ongoing economic battle, and all the other kind of crazy stuff that we're used to in the U.S. empire system and other systems around the world, they just, it's like, okay, dissenters, go off and have a nice day. Also giving these other examples here, the great law of peace coming out from the Haudenosaunee, their constitution, this is explained by Orrin Lyons, the faith keeper of the Turtle Clan, a member of the Onondaga Council of Chiefs. The essence, the first principle is peace, the second principle, equity, justice for the people. And third, the power of the good minds, of the collective powers to be of one mind, unity, and health. All of these were involved in the basic principles and the process of discussion, putting aside warfare as a method of reaching decisions, and now using intellect. And then it cites the Muscogees, or Creeks, and the Seminoles, and other peoples in the Southeast had three branches of government, a civil administration, a military, and a branch that dealt with, ready for it? The sacred. And that is also what is cited by Orrin Lyons as what was left out of what the U.S. Got from the Haudenosaunee Constitution to make the U.S. Constitution was, he said, they left out the spirit world. They left out the, you know, the connection with the spirit beings, which is an integral part of Native peoples, and really from a holistic, mystical point of view, that every being, even a rock, has a spirit being. So you don't just mess with the rock like what's being done with fracking and shale oil, but you somehow communicate with it before doing anything to see if you get the approval. And another thing, maybe mentioned last show in Wolin's book, is he talks about, you know, when empire falls, will there be a democratic revival, or will inverted totalitarianism still go on, or will there be something else? So the way he presents it, it's like the inverted totalitarian system is so ingrained and so subtle in its meshings with the media and education and corporation that, you know, the empire could fail, but that would not necessarily mean the end of the system, so to speak. And here I have a note, rhetorical democracy and imperial abroad. So that's another another bit that gets highlighted in here. He hides it quite dramatically. The culmination of inauthentic politics was the great hoax concocted by the Bush team while rhetorically exploiting democracy in support of imperial ambitions abroad. It undermined at home the process by which the democratic ballot bestows legitimacy. In both the 2000 and 2004 presidential elections, Bush's minions employed tactics that revealed the chain of corruption extending from local officials to the highest court, all with the intention of thwarting the popular will. The long-run consequences may prove more significant than the clouded elections, a popular distrust of the significance of elections themselves. In sum, republicanism has given the nation not an alternate, but a genuine alternative, an inegalitarian social democracy and a bogus political democracy. But again, the whole thing of exploiting democracy at home while promoting so-called democracy abroad, and there's a big irony or hypocrisy in there. The hypocrisy of the democracy. It sort of starts a little bit of a rap poem there. And backtracking a little bit, National Security Council, he's citing around World War II. After World War II, I think especially the national security and things started to go global. And, you know, he cites that as part of the age we're in now with this whole global issues to consider. One of my, quote, favorite things, he talks about the way he ties in the products, the whole corporate advertising and products as a way to, quote, be reborn. And I would dub it a materialist evangelism. It's like the people are convinced that, you know, it's not even like religion doesn't have to do the thing anymore. It's this corporate religion of convincing people that by, using this and that product, that they can be reborn. And but meanwhile, that contrasts with, you know, cutting social services. So it becomes this very vain and veneer-looking society. And part of what he also talks about as far as how do they pull off this inverted totalitarian system, and he refers to it as the normalizing an atmosphere of fear. To normalize it, to sort of have it be that it's, you know, it's in the background from wherever, from the Cold War to, to current stuff. It's like whoever the boogeyman is, it's sort of, you know, people just go about their business, but in the background it has that, it's just normal that there's some level of fear. And he refers to the Cold War and the McCarthy era with their blacklists and suspected, you know, the suspected Reds. And that was kind of a start of internal suspicions, and distrusting and an internal thing going on that it's still prevalent in some ways today, many ways today. And here's Wolin again saying, the second development was intimately connected with the priority of foreign policy and military preparedness, the emergence and legitimation of elitism of a political class, the best and the brightest. This is talking about consequences of Cold War upon domestic politics. One was the shrinking place occupied by politics and the enlargement of state power. The growing dominance of foreign policy and military strategy altered the scope and status of public participation. So again, as he talked about, there's not like really one point where this whole thing started. It's been a sort of subtle, gradual eroding. Again, you have to study some history to realize like what is happening today is not just today, and to connect some dots. That it really makes history as, you know, essential for helping to understand things and to see through what could be seen as just now, which, you know, is a way to hit the panic button for a lot of people. And Wolin continues, the clear implication was that elitism was the antidote to mass ignorance and essential to victory in the struggle for freedom. Elitism signified a privileged claim to power on the part of those who not only manifested proven intelligence, experience, and sterling character, but also, unlike the fantasy-prone masses, were realists. A whole ideology emerged to legitimate elitism. So you have this whole, you know, this sort of seeds of a superior race, the elite, the control, to put the people in their place, and these all very sort of subtle things, the normalizing of fear, but over time, the sort of institutionalizing of them to the point where people, that's my words, people don't even realize that they are living in an inverted totalitarian system. So that's, again, one of the things I found the most fascinating about Wolin's whole theory and the presentation is that whole sort of human, the psychology element that's going on. And his triumvirate he cites in the book are science, technology, and capitalism as driving forces of the culture. Science, technology, capitalism. You know, the latest gadget, the latest invention. Science can do this, and it's backed by capitalism. And however many combos that those work tend to become the sort of leading edge. And here's this is a really good bit to show the an example of the science. In that triumvirate, science as business, market-oriented. A half a century ago, the work of scientists was idealized. Typically, science was depicted almost monastically as pursued within a community of scientists that constrained their behavior in accordance with an unwritten code of conduct for protecting scientific objectivity and integrity. Scientists operated outside the marketplace. Their autonomy, which was considered to be the necessary condition for scientific honesty, was subsidized by government and universities. Now, however, scientists have become incorporated, either as entrepreneurs or as employees in research divisions of corporations and government bureaucracies. The integration of science into the culture and practices of corporate and governmental bureaucracies has destroyed the iconic status it enjoyed for more than three centuries, leaving scientists and their findings more vulnerable to political and corporate manipulation and attacks by religious and economic archaists. Once scientists were universally revered as exemplars of independent truth-seeking, of knowledge for its own sake, but in recent years they've been accused of fraud, misrepresenting their findings, and other forms of cheating reflective of a highly competitive, market-oriented culture. More significant, on virtually every major policy issue from global warming to genetic engineering, apparently reputable scientists can be found appealing to scientific evidence and theories while defending diametrically opposed positions. While some may welcome these revelations for eliminating the last holdout against postmodern subjectivism, there can be little question that they, along with the corporatization of science, further weaken public confidence in the possibility of disinterested policies and public trust in authorities. Paradoxically, the demystification of science and its incorporation into the power complex have worked to the advantage of religious fundamentalists. Beginning in the 19th century and continuing throughout much of the 20th, science was widely regarded as the most powerful alternative system of beliefs that challenged organized religion for hegemony. Although the echoes of these controversies can occasionally be heard today in the curriculum battles between creationists and Darwinians, what tends to be obscured is the reversal in influence and popularity of the antagonists since the Scopes trial. Today it is religion, not science, that is in ascendancy, that holds the loyalties of those who believe. So he goes on and on. It's again, the fascinating subsectors of the corporation and the state. And part of that bit reminded me of Charles Fort, who wrote extensively about the science being the kind of new religion back in the, 40s earlier, science becoming like a new religion in that, it was sort of within the box science and did not allow for the something, experiences and things that could not be explained, which is similar to the way that the inverted totalitarianism works. It's like something that cannot be explained or is a wild card gets written out of the script. And here he starts a chapter called Politics of Superpower Managed Democracy, Superpower is the union of state and corporation in an age of waning democracy and political illiteracy. This chapter inquires into some of the political changes that are making superpower and inverted totalitarianism possible and demoting democracy from a formative principle to a largely rhetorical function within an increasingly corrupt political system. The crux of these changes is that corporate power and its culture are no longer external forces that occasionally influence policies and legislation. As these have become integral, so the citizenry has become marginable and democracy more manageable. What follows is an account of these developments. So again, this sort of normalizing, numbing, sheeple, dreamwalking, sleepwalking type of modus operandi that is sort of being promoted as a kind of well-oiled machine. And one thing I found really interesting, a more sort of psychology note or understanding people, is he mentioned the trauma of the Peloponnesian War produced a profound anti-democratic reaction among the Athenian political and intellectual elites. It was not until the English Civil Wars of the mid-17th century that the political and intellectual elites' picture of the demos was challenged by modern democratic ideas of equal rights and popular political participation. So the whole thing about trauma is I find fascinating, as you know, the whole post-traumatic stress disorder, mention of, you know, Native people just learning that over the years, reading their stories about how there still is still kind of a legacy of trauma that's passed down to generations that takes, you know, shedding that stuff, and I think here he's kind of citing this. Whatever the trauma of the Peloponnesian War was, they had a reaction to it, and that ended up having a big shaping effect on the world. And part of the talking about Machiavelli and a Machiavellian shift, and just as a small section, a citizen should, for example, serve in the militia and, above all, stand with those who were sworn to defend republican institutions and were skilled in their management. Toward the end, the citizens were to be educated, taught that loyalty was owed to their city or state rather than to noble patrons. So there's that shift that I mentioned in before about the sort of first part of democracy and corporations breaking away from the church and the aristocracy and certain authoritarian views, but that subtle shift that instead of, you know, the allegiance being to specific patrons or say a king, that emotion got stirred to be devoted to one's, you know, city, state, country, whatever. And another key thing, with the possible and ambivalent exception of Jefferson, the American Republicans were steadfast critics of democracy. When they decided that it was time to draft a new constitution, they treated as axiomatic that a modern political system had to make concessions to democratic sentiments without conceding governance to the people. So this is certainly a trend that has followed through, kind of certain reforms that have happened, but yet not really letting go. I see that even with the civil rights, as positive as the civil rights movement was, and what came out of that. Looking now, and they have this modern slavery prison industrial complex. So it's like, how do you weigh where is the progress and how much? You know, in a way, I can say that the civil rights movement, although positive, and you know, could be built on to make changes now. In a way, it was just a reform. It did not really change the system. And Wolin continues, accordingly, they composed a masterful translation of republicanism that drew a line indicating what was to be allowed and what excluded from the democratic aspirations aroused by the struggle for independence from Britain. While they recognized the people as a political presence, they proceeded to dilute the potential of democratic power by constraints intended to filter out any grand schemes. An elaborate system of checks and balances, separation of powers, an electoral college to select the president, and later judicial review were designed to make it next to impossible for popular majorities to institute policies actually in the interests of the majority. So again, compare that with Native people's consensus. And you know, this is sort of this built-in divide and conquer, but in a very subtle way. You know, the checks and balances, separation of powers, electoral college, it's like, it's very subtly done. And another sort of aim of the hypocrisy, the aim of the counter-revolutionary strategy is the permanent institutionalization of a counter-democratic state. Meanwhile, military spending is nearly four times greater than the expenditures on social programs. Yet neither party would dream of proposing an amendment specifically limiting or controlling military spending, only one prohibiting same-sex marriage. Again, the same-sex marriages, that goes through, which is wonderful in its way, but again, when we step away or step back or look at the bigger picture, it stirs up a lot of this other stuff. So, kind of looking forward, it looks like maybe one, like, this is sort of like Globalist Then, could do 20 shows, but looking like maybe one or two will sum it up, some more notes, and then towards the end, Wolin, you know, does have a list of what he emphasizes as solutions. Not a large part of the book, but certainly worth mentioning, and is, you know, it does come as a big exclamation point at the end of the book. And another loose connection with the mentalities of previous totalitarian regimes mentioned here, talking about, let's see, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Donald Rumsfeld was the incarnation of the blending of the corporate and governmental worlds and was renowned for his nonsense approach, or no-nonsense approach, either one. The last person one would associate with esoterica or love of abstract truth, and the first person one might nominate is the embodiment of crude drive for power per se. He has been an elected representative, a member of the White House staff, and the chief executive of one of the largest pharmaceutical corporations, and he is a former member of the Princeton wrestling team. Notwithstanding, his one-time second-in-command, Assistant Secretary Paul Wolfowitz, was a Straussian who presumably would not have been appointed without Rumsfeld's approval. By all accounts, Wolfowitz, along with other initiates, was among the principal architects of the invasion of Iraq. Perhaps it is relevant to note that before leaving Nazi Germany, Strauss, that's with two S's, S-T-R-A-U-S-S, enjoyed close intellectual relations with Carl Schmitt, a political and legal philosopher who collaborated with the Nazis and enjoyed official favor. Moreover, before and after he left Germany, he offered no harsh public criticism of either Hitler or Mussolini. To understand what at first glance appeared to be the extremely odd couple of Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz, we must briefly look at the master's teaching, inquiring how its particular form of archaism could contribute to the dynamic of superpower, to the practice of elitism, and to the subversion of democracy. Like superpower itself, Straussism is based upon a fantasy about power, in this case the power to be found in a most unlikely form, philosophy. Unlike most of the fantasts of scientific and technological power who are rapturous about the material benefits for humankind that such powers can bring, Strauss was a fantast who warned of the harm to the masses that the true philosophy would wreak should the many ever gain a glimpse of its meaning and implications. And riffing on Wolin talking about science and technology, it got me to express that it's like the science and technology without feeling, without human emotion, is this monster machine, and that's connected you know, with a lot of the military usage. But whereas ancient Greece had the Deus Ex Machina, God coming out of a machine to save the day, it's like this modern technology has created this machina sans Deus, the machine without God. So that is just something to something that we need, humanity needs to change, to look at, make, you know, change. One more long section here, I'll wrap it up for today, and Wolin really nails the hypocrisy, the elites claiming that the masses are unruly. Elites are supposed to withstand the gales of popular passion, stand firm for what is right against what the founding father Madison described as, quote, the confusion and intemperance of a multitude, end quote. And yet, the most disastrous wars in American history have been instigated not by rabid majorities, but by elites. The The Southern aristocracy provoked the Civil War. The best and the brightest led the country into the quagmire of Vietnam and Bush's advisory Vulcans, and the neocon products of elite universities have made of Iraq a national and international nightmare. The irrationalism of superpower is the result of a fearful asymmetry. From one perspective, superpower is inconceivable without the extraordinary intelligence at work in modern science and technology. Among the qualities of that intelligence are exactness, discrimination, sensitivity to counter-evidence, skepticism toward faith-based claims, and mindfulness of consequences. From another perspective, however, a willful naivete is at work. Scientists invent instruments of unprecedented power for those who are motivated not by intellectual curiosity or the common good, but by power or profit or some combination of the two. Dresden, Hiroshima, Nagasaki were triumphs of scientific knowledge and technological ingenuity, but also of a political irrationality that began with the rationale of saving an unknown number of American soldiers' lives and ended by employing against Japanese cities weaponry whose destructive effects were untested, hence uncertain, at least the first time around. A process that began with rationality organized on a human scale, a lab, a university, ended in irrationality. A huge Manhattan Project devastated cities, the fatally contaminated survivors, the ashes of countless dead, a counter-Holocaust. The odyssey of superpower might be described in these terms. From Einstein's abstract equations scrawled on a blackboard to the bunker busters' shock and awe unleashed in Iraq against an entire society. Notwithstanding President Bush's previous description of an unconventional enemy that had to be hunted down, quote, one terrorist at a time, end quote. At this writing, according to one estimate, there have been 100,000 Iraqi civilian casualties since the American invasion. So that wraps up that chapter of Elites Against Democracy, and I remember seeing reports that perhaps 1 million Iraqis have died. This book was 2008, so yeah, that would take some web stat looking, but perhaps 500,000 to 1 million, whatever the number is, just, you know, like the Bob Dylan song, the answer is blowing in the wind. How many deaths will it take till they see that too many people have died? So, you know, also the U.S., I think the U.S. reached a point of as many, perhaps in about 3,000 or so, as many suicides as deaths from the war. So that in itself is a powerful statement. That's a bit of a heavy note to wrap up on, but it shows why Wolin, this book is so powerful, because he's not just theorizing, he's not just talking about, you know, theory and this is like this, but he really gets to the nitty-gritty, and it shows how these sort of theories play out in reality and how devastating they can be in effect, and why it's so important to make people aware and to make some changes. So thank you again for listening. Have a good one. Peace out. Peace in. And thinking of the Native Peoples Consensus, just web searched and found International Jazz Consensus Love Song, 1981, composed by Lala Kovacev, K-O-V-A-C-E-V, if that's the right pronunciation. So here it is.